listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording still from the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York.
And I am your co-host, Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
Good to be back with you, Katie. How you doing?
Doing well.
Yeah, it's August. I hope our listeners are enjoying their summers. Katie and I thought we would use this occasion to reflect once again on the fate of Afghanistan. Right, this is roughly 3 years since the untimely withdrawal from the untimely fall of Afghanistan, rather, to the Taliban once again in 2021. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about this earlier this year, where we reflected a bit on the Taliban's kind of recognition, the new geopolitics of Afghanistan and Central Asia more broadly, where we talked a bit about the role of countries like China and India. But Katie, I think, you know, 3 years on, I think there's a lot to kind of continue to reflect on here, the role of the Afghan diaspora, the continuing kind of will they, won't they of various neighboring countries regarding their relationship with the Taliban government. But, you know, what's on your mind when it comes to Afghanistan today, 3 years on? I mean, this is a country that I think Americans have largely stopped talking about. It's not a live issue on the in the context of the election or anything like that. But of course, Afghanistan continues to be a central concern for many of the countries in the region, given everything from the Taliban's approach to human rights internally and its broader engagement now with its neighboring countries. So what's on your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, as the anniversary passed in mid-August at the Diplomat, we ran a number of articles about Afghanistan Today, and a lot of them really did hone in on the really depressing plight of Afghan women, girls, and minorities in Afghanistan, and just this sense that, you know, if you went back to Afghanistan of 2001 and then compared it to Afghanistan of 2020, you would have seen such a radical difference in not just the economy, but in the lives of everyday Afghans. And a big part of that was the fact that women could engage more fully in society. They could go to school, they could get degrees, they could become ministers. There weren't a lot of them, but they had sort of this trajectory of progress. And then you sort of jump to 2024, and, you know, we had a reporter who was in Afghanistan, and the report that she filed is just really, it's very, you know, depressing is not a strong enough word for it, just sort of the level of oppression that Afghan women live with. And, you know, the fact that, like, this isn't just like a women's issue. If you want to sort of set aside the idea that women are equal human beings, even on just a basic economic level, the Taliban has deleted them from the economy. Women cannot proceed in school past sixth grade. They can't really work outside of the home. They can't pursue higher education. And that inevitably has an economic impact, particularly because there is a not insignificant number of Afghan households that are women led. And so if the main breadwinner can no longer win bread, what do? Starve. And just to put some figures to that, last year, so in 2023, looking at 2022, the UNDP found that 84% of the Afghan population spends less than $30 per person per month. So that's $1 a day, which is the national poverty line. So nearly the entire country is in poverty. And so that is a reality that I think we do have to sit with. And the fact is that these things are not really taken as seriously on an international level. And there are geopolitical angles to this and security angles. There's a wider economic thing. But at the core, there's a human tragedy that is unfolding.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this human tragedy, I mean, to the extent that the West has continued to take an interest in Afghanistan and dealing with the Taliban government, you know, there has been an attempt to apply pressure to try and encourage some kind of change, even though I think everybody acknowledges that the Taliban are going to, you know, they're not fundamentally going to opt for a different approach. But, I mean, for the United States and its European partners in particular, right, non-recognition, which is what we talked about the last time we talked about Afghanistan, has been seen as really the key lever that the West possesses vis-a-vis the Taliban government. They want recognition. By withholding recognition, the U.S. And Europe can potentially incentivize some kind of change pertaining to human rights or governance more broadly. Except, Katie, as we sort of talked about last time, recognition of the Taliban government is starting to snowball, right? We talked about China, we talked about India, we talked about sort of neighboring countries. And I think that sort of blows open a hole in this broader strategy, because the Taliban, I think, you know, there might be a miscalculation of the extent to which the Taliban really does need Western recognition per se. In fact, I think the Taliban itself has started to sort of also make changes on this front. At the end of July, for instance, they severed diplomatic relations. Well, not diplomatic relations, but they stopped dealing with the former Afghan diplomatic missions in 14 European countries, basically continuing to sort of emphasize that they had options apart from engaging the West more broadly. So that strikes me as a really important piece of this. Like, geopolitically, I just think efforts to isolate the Taliban have not worked. I mean, the Taliban is not globally integrated by any means, but they have a sufficient ability to engage with the powers that do have an interest in Afghanistan nearby, like China and India and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, the and we did talk about this previously, the issue of recognition is really interesting, because any article you read about Afghanistan will mention that the Taliban is not formally recognized by any country in the world. But I don't know that, I agree with you, I don't know that that formal recognition really matters as much to the Taliban as maybe it did in 2022. And that's because it does have fairly normal, or at least approaching normal, relations with China, with Russia, with Kazakhstan, with Uzbekistan. The Uzbek prime minister visited Afghanistan earlier this month, and he was he's the prime minister, and Uzbekistan is a presidential, very towards the autocratic end of presidential system, but he's the highest global official to have visited Afghanistan since 2021. And they signed, I think it was $2.5 billion in trade and investment deals. That might have been million. I have to fact check myself on that. A significant sum of trade and investment deals. And sort of reading through the news reports of this visit, it was as if one prime minister visiting a neighboring country. It was very normal. The sort of governance issues were not mentioned. All reference to like an inclusive or elected government in Afghanistan entirely deleted from any of these conversations. And so you do see this treating the Taliban government as a normal government, in particular by the closely neighboring states. And part of that, I think if you asked those governments, they would say it's the pragmatic path. This is our neighbor. We have to deal with them. And there might be some weight to that. But on the other hand, that does give them a position of influence that the West really does not have. And it's pretty clear that China, Uzbekistan is not using that influence to sort of anything other than economic ends, or at least that's my sort of assessment of that.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's important to kind of continue to pay attention, as you sort of talked about, the sort of normalization of these relationships is sort of where there are Taliban diplomats that are sort of being accepted as ambassadors. China accepted one in December 2023. Kazakhstan this week is recognizing a Taliban diplomat as the charge d'affaires in Astana. And so, you know, this is approaching a normal level of engagement. And so, you know, when we talk about recognition, in sort of my mind, if it walks like recognition and it talks like recognition, it is essentially recognition. And I think we should stop fooling ourselves. But back to the original point is the idea that, you know, if the global community could have denied that recognition, then sure, but there's a pressure valve, and it's led by China that sort of enables the Taliban to continue to behave as the legitimate governor of Afghanistan, which a lot of Afghans would disagree with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing to highlight here is also, I think, some of the security concerns that these countries have, right? I mean, we sometimes, you know, I mean, as awful as the Taliban is, I mean, the Taliban is continuing to fight the Islamic State in Afghanistan, too. And that's, of course, a major concern for many of these other countries who have now started to sort of engage with the Taliban, right? Which, compared to the Islamic State, is, I think, seen for many of these capitals as the lesser of two evils. I mean, literally, in terms of the potential for Afghanistan to once again become a staging ground for the Islamic State or for other groups that might seek to carry out terrorist attacks outside. But, you know, I should note here that the Taliban's efforts to fight the Islamic State are largely, I think, motivated by their own interest to control Afghan territory and to exercise political control. I don't think they're doing this as a way to sort of build goodwill with many of these countries that have now started to engage. But I think that is really the fundamental dilemma here. And, you know, I think when it comes to the West, I mean, I don't see any particular momentum here for this approach that relies on treating non-recognition as leverage fundamentally changing? Again, I mean, I don't think there's Afghanistan's lost salience as an issue when it comes to how I think the United States just talks about this part of the world, right? Very, very, very little continuing focus apart from the continuing efforts on sort of resettling Afghans who have left the country. But in terms of dealing with the Taliban and trying to continue to change the country, I think there's just a complete loss of momentum there.
Yeah, and there's a sense of not really, at least it's my sense, nobody really knows what to do necessarily. You know, the sort of idea of recognizing the Taliban as a legitimate government, the West seems pretty set against doing. But on the edges, there are these efforts to sort of engage. We can kind of look at the Doha meetings. Sort of the third Doha meeting was infamously just the Taliban. Mm-hmm. Previous meetings had been just sort of Afghan diaspora and sort of opposition groups, former government, and Westerners. And you know, there's a lot of contention around that. You know, can the UN sort of get the Taliban to engage sort of in good faith? I don't know. I know a lot of Afghans are not convinced that they can, but we shall see where those efforts go. I know there's just a lot of, like, everyone's at a loss for how to approach this.
Mm-hmm. All right, Katie. Well, I think we'll leave it there today. But you know, we are getting close to the end of August, which means, of course, that we have another issue of the Diplomats magazine just around the corner. So, do you want to give our listeners a little bit of a preview of what they have to look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. So our cover story for the next issue of the magazine is going to focus on, actually, it'll be a little bit interesting and relevant to listeners of this podcast. It's going to look at the Koreas and the sort of influence of their domestic politics, sort of the domestic politics in South Korea on that bilateral relationship or lack thereof with North Korea, and sort of the interplay between domestic politics and geopolitics and security and things like that. And then we have a really excellent update on Kashmir, which our listeners will remember 5 years ago. 5 years ago in August, the Indian government essentially abrogated Jammu and Kashmir's special status, and sort of a check-in on where things are in Kashmir now. And then we're going to mark the five-year anniversary of Solomon Islands' switch in recognition from Taiwan to China, with an article written by a journalist in Solomon Islands about the impact of that switch. Did the government achieve what it had hoped it would achieve with that switch, and sort of where has that left the country economically and politically at present? And then we have a very great interview with Amin Saikal, who wrote a book. He's Australian-based Afghan academic who wrote a book titled How to Lose a War, which is about the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan. Is really insightful view on sort of where the United States went wrong. So that's a really great interview, and there's a lot else in the a lot of other things in the issue as well, sort of great. Across the board, but hope everyone checks it out.
Absolutely. Yeah, so make sure you subscribe to the magazine so you can access those terrific articles that Katie talked about. And for listeners of the podcast, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while but you haven't yet left us a review, please do so. We really do appreciate that. It helps the podcast grow. And finally, if you have suggestions for future coverage, do reach out to either of us. We're very happy to take that into consideration. So, Katie, I think we'll leave it there, and see you back in Washington in September for the next episode. We'll be back soon with more.
Absolutely.